Persecution, trial, and tribulation. The Church of God the Eternal presents the number 12 tape in this series of vital interest and intense concern to every Christian. Your speaker is Mr. Raymond Cole.
We've covered so many, many of the points now dealing with the fundamental aspects of trial, tribulation, and persecution. But I wanted to go through what God gave as historical examples so that we have a premise, a good solid basis for what I want to cover in the New Testament, the things that are coming. Because whatsoever was written aforetime was written for our admonition and our learning. And God has given us some very finite examples. He's given us an insight to what happens under given circumstances. But given circumstances and the historical application of them is of value only if we recognize the veracity of the past. In other words, if we read all the circumstances of the past and then turn right around and say they are no longer applicable, that they're relegated to the historical past, then we have not achieved much. We've consumed a little time, but that's about it. But if we recognize the historical examples as valid in our lives, and from which we can derive explanatory factors with respect to the present and the future, then the past will have been relevant and meaningful. So now, point number five, in dealing with this word, let's see, what was it, Tzarath, I believe? Yes, T-Z-A-H, Tzarath, rather, one of the basic Hebrew words of, in this case, I believe, trial or tribulation, and they're both the same. So it's, Tzarath is one of the basic Hebrew words for trial or tribulation. And we have covered the subtopics of God subjects all called of Him to necessary trials. And then point number two is how and for what reason does God try? And number three, trials and refinement are useless unless there is a positive result. And number four, which we covered last week, specific times and circumstances wherein God tries His people. But point number five then today is the attitude of those who are sincere know the intent involved. One of the cardinal principles necessary to achieve maximum benefit from trial or experience is to understand its relevance to our own personal lives. If we relegate it to the past, or if we relegate it to somebody else, or if we never view it in light of our own personal circumstances, then it is of little value. But those who are of God, who are sincere, know the intent and the purpose. They realize why they are experiencing various things. All of us are going to experience certain adversity. It is the inevitable result of living in a society that is entirely, universally intent on pursuing the way of flesh, and yet you're going contrary to that. So if you're going contrary to the acceptable norm of human beings living in their own way, their own environment, and their own circumstances, and you're living contrary to it, then obviously you're like the fish that is swimming contrary to the current. You're going to encounter some difficulty. It is a must, therefore, to understand that element of difficulty which we experience as a result of doing the will of God versus that which we have precipitated for ourselves by our own defective natures or characters. So it's necessary to look down into our lives. Jesus Christ, who lived perfectly, also suffered indescribable anguish and pain. Why? Because he lived in the fabric of a society that was completely devoid of his orientation. And so he suffered. He paid a price. And yet, on the other hand, he could say at the conclusion of his life, his peace and his joy he was going to leave with us. What peace and what joy if you look only at the tangible results of his life? Rejected, spurned, they spat in his face, they ridiculed, they threatened, and they beleaguered him at every turn of the road. One might ask, what joy could he leave? What joy could he have possibly experienced? The joy of knowing God, God's truth, and fulfilling his purpose. There is an awesome spiritual joy that is absolutely profound if we know the truth of God, if we understand the purpose of God, we know the will of God, even in obedience to those very things, because we can look objectively to the future, beyond the veil of the present. And we realize that there are some awesome, awesome things that are to be achieved. What if you gain the whole world today and lose the hope of your soul, your life? Would you exchange it? So, brethren, we may go through the momentary, temporary trials of this world, many difficulties and unique situations, and yet our minds who are fixed upon God, upon the eternal, on Jesus Christ, can in the face of death, of murder, of adversity, of every indescribable anxiety, frustration, and pain, yet manifest the optimum joy of God's Spirit. It's all a matter of mental orientation, if we see and if we understand. But the attitude of those who are sincere know the intent. They can properly evaluate their lives. They can carve out the differences. They know that which they have accepted by reason of acceptance of God's truth, which is inevitable. Suffering within our own mental makeup, our own physical makeup, the sufferings of Jesus Christ. We can carve those out and separate them from that which we have brought upon ourselves because of our defective natures or our characters. So I want us to turn now to Psalms 26 and note verse 2. Psalms, the 26th chapter, and verse 2. Examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Try my reins and my heart. Do we come before God asking for that trial? Asking that we may know the difference? That we can look at our lives and say, my God, I thank you for the strength that you've given through your Spirit. Because I know, by virtue of what I have already gone through, that I can weather the storms of tomorrow. Or do we look back on our trials, the circumstances of our life, and say, I don't know, because I miserably failed too many times. You know, if I can be forthright and honest before you, I wasn't born with a slow nor an unfertile mind. My mind has always worked very rapidly. And you know, that can be a gigantic curse. As I've had to sit on a mind in a way that maybe some haven't had to. Maybe you have faster minds than I do, and if you do, then you know what I'm talking about. Because to bring that mind into captivity to Christ is not an easy thing. When there are times with tears in my eyes, I've had to cry out to God, take the temptation away. You fight and you fight and you fight until you're almost worn down, as they say, to a nubbin. Have you ever gone through those things? Of course, all of you have your minds whipped and in line. You don't have any problems. No problem to you. But it is to me. It's a struggle. And you fight. Because you don't want that mind to have its own sway and to do its own thing. And to be an open prey for the influence of Satan or any of his cohorts. I guess the strongest battles I fight are mental. A lot of people have other unique problems. You know, certain lustful appetites or whatever it may be. Some of those things don't bother me. They haven't as long as I've lived. So perhaps I'm not in a position to say to somebody who has, you know, a certain physical appetite, whatever it may be, I may not be in a position to condemn that individual. But when it comes to mental struggles, then I think I'm in the ballpark. And anybody who has it, I have nothing but sympathy for them. Because I'll tell you, if we begin to really struggle against that which exalts itself against the knowledge of God, the arrogancy and conceit of a human mind, its vanity, its wretchedness, its own utter carnal stupidity, if we don't cater to it, and if we really begin to struggle against it, I want to tell you, you have found your match. I find the unique problem with too many people is that they cater to it. In so many ways. Dirty stories. Innuendo. Hypercriticism. We just do not have the control that we should have. But I'm getting into what I want to cover later on. I'm trying to lay the foundation at the present time. And then we're going to get back to how they affect us and the things that we'd better be doing about it. But the prayer is, by the psalmist David, as an inspired part of God's word, that we had better ask for the intervention of God in examining us. And an examination always reveals areas of weakness, does it not? When you took, if any of you ever took SAT exams, and I'm not in favor of SATs, I'm only using the theory because we commonly understand them. Those are the standard aptitude tests, you know, showing what your proclivities or your capabilities may be. If any of you took those, you found you were strong in certain areas and you were weak in others. No human being is strong in every area. The only person that has ever been perfect in all areas is God. All the rest of us were created only with a part of the potential of God, humanly speaking. And we have our strong points and we have our weak points. Not every human being that was born with the ability to be a masterful musician. Not every human being born is a mathematician. And not every human being born is a farmer. Let me assure you that it takes just as much scientific capability for that farmer to produce and do a good job as it does for Dr. So-and-so down at Caltech to put a piece of metal around Jupiter. The only thing is, we don't recognize priorities and capabilities. We seem to have given certain aura of recognition and glory to certain jobs, and the rest of them we have reduced, you know, to the mundane. But let me tell you, if there were to be any classification, prioritizing of responsibilities, that of a carpenter and a farmer would certainly not be on the bottom. But that's where Satan, in the structure of his society, has attempted to put them. You know, oftentimes they're referred to as those just dirt farmers. What do they mean by that? It's a contemptuous term. As though there's some other kind of a farmer. No, we don't all have the same strengths. And any time we begin to categorize jobs or sins or weaknesses or capabilities, we render a giant disservice to everybody involved, including yours truly. Who is to say that your weakness is less of a problem than my weakness? Only in the eyes of the beholder, or the one who's experiencing it. Our prayer ought to be in a general sense, examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Try my reins. He isn't praying that for somebody else. He isn't saying, O Lord, my God, you know how righteous I am, but why don't you get after that fellow over there that causes me my constant heartache? You know, I'd have a pretty good life if it weren't for so-and-so. Remember the publican? And which one went down justified? Not a one of us is in a position to condemn anyone else. And when we do, it is obvious it is a manifestation of a defective weakness in our own character. And when the manifestation becomes obvious, if we're carefully examining ourselves, our behavioral patterns, our thought patterns, it ought to force us into a knee-bending configuration before God, asking for true repentance and to be set aright with Him once again. Examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Try my reins and my heart. Because I want to know. I want to know where I stand. I want to know where my weaknesses are so that I can begin to work on them. Because God is not going to allow any weaknesses in His kingdom. We're going to have to master them. And the very obvious manifestation of a weakness shows the obvious necessity of the strength and the character of God. But you can't have it without praying. Asking for the help of God, predicated on a prior condition, true repentance, which means the acknowledgement of the weakness itself. So the attitude of those who are sincere know the intent, because they're asking for it. They want to know. They want to understand. And they want to fulfill the purpose of God. Point number six. It's used simply for one who works with metals. To show you, because, you know, Romans 1:20 tells us that we can understand the awesome purposes of God by the things which have been created. If that is true, in all the awesome broad perspective of the plan and the purpose of God, is it not also true in the more finite that deal with us in specific areas? And so God used the mere metallurgical process of refinement purification, the chemistry process itself. As an example of that process that's going on in some organic chemistry. You. And if we'll just look out, we'll see the physical example, then we'll know what God's purpose is here. Because the correlation is precise and absolute. And so if God uses heat or structured the fabric of our physical realm to become malleable, usable, so that we can form it and fashion it and shape it, whatever the metal may be, by the artistic use of heat, then does not that very physical example also show that heat is implicitly necessary in making us malleable so that we can be fashioned into the likeness of the glory of God? And heat or fire have always been representative of trial and tribulation. Trial and tribulation may have a definitive beginning and end in the sense of a specified period of time. But in the generalized acceptance of the term, it means the buffeting which we're experiencing day by day. Those things which we are encountering. And every one of us goes through the trial, the crucible of fire, heat, day by day. If we're not going through it, it means that we're not being processed. It means that we're not resisting. When that wife wants to speak her contemptuous feeling to a husband, she's tried indescribably at that moment. Will she come to grips with it? Or will she cater to the whim? The husband that wants to become wrathful and distraught and abuses the responsive position of his wife. Does he recognize it? And the one does not have the right to point the finger at the other. One of the age-old expressions coined by Satan the devil is, when you make a change, I will. What difference does it make what the other one does? Your hope of life is dependent not on what somebody else does, but on what you do. And then the monumental problem generated in our society today for teenagers or children, when they manifest little respect for parents. And I don't care how old parents become, we owe respect to them as long as they're on earth. And what an honor to respect them. It's what God expects of us. But let's pray. Examine me. And let's use those cardinal physical examples of metallurgy to realize the process we're going through. In Nehemiah 3:8, the term goldsmith is used. And a goldsmith is nothing more than a refiner in that process. The term is saraf. Same word. Although it's used in the nominative form. In Nehemiah 3 and verse 32, the word goldsmith once again, as also in Isaiah 41 and verse 7, the word goldsmith. So it's used simply to describe the work of one who is employed in handling metals, the manufacture of metals, or the use of metals. The original process of the development of metals and the subsequent process in the development of a specific fashion, form, or shape. The same word is employed. Point number seven. What is the purpose of trials? The purpose of trials. In Proverbs 25, beginning in verse 1, with emphasis on verse 4, Proverbs, the 25th chapter, and beginning in verse 1, the preacher Solomon wrote, "These are also proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied out. It is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but it seems to be the glory of men to reveal them. But the honor of kings is to search out a matter. The heaven for height, the earth for depth, and the heart of kings is unsearchable." And he could have added, human beings. Knowing human beings is unfathomable. "Take away the dross from the silver, and there shall come forth a vessel for the finer." In this case, the word finer. Take away the dross from the silver. It's a process, a metallurgical process, by which the dregs are removed. And the removal of those dregs is likened unto the removal of our deficiencies or our character, the lack of character. "And there shall come forth a vessel for the finer." God is responsible for making us into a fashionable, acceptable, glorified vessel of glory. We can't make ourselves into it, no more than can the piece of metal. It can be 100% silver, but it cannot stand up in its own right and say, "I'm going to be a candelabra." It takes an outside force to make it, to fashion it, to develop it. But there is another responsibility, brethren. And that responsibility is in the refining process, in making the metal pure first. That's where you and I are involved. Because we've got to get rid of the dross. And God manifests it. And there is a mutual responsibility in the purification of the silver or the gold. The mutual responsibility requires the services both of God and man in purifying the metal. The vessel that God intends to make is of his own choosing. He'll make you what he wills that you be. You have no option in that. But I don't really want one. I'll be most happy to be what God wants me to be. It's just that I'd like to be 100% pure metal. And I have a responsibility in that, and so do you. So he said, "Take away the dross from the silver." That's our responsibility. In an acceptable service, a united mutual relationship with God, where we're working by the Spirit of God, the power that is necessary to eliminate the defects or the dross. "And there shall come forth a vessel for the finer. Take away the wicked from before the king, and his throne shall be established in righteousness." It is a parable uttered by the lips of Solomon, but it is applicable to the King of Kings, the glorious King, that is to be established upon his throne, and there isn't going to be any wickedness standing before him. Only vessels of honor. The wicked here likened unto those from whom the dross has not been removed. The righteous are those 100% pure silver. Isaiah the 40th chapter. Isaiah 40 And let's begin in verse 18 with emphasis on verse 19. Isaiah 40 and beginning in verse 18. To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare unto him? What examples are you going to use? What objects are you going to use to whom you might compare God, or to which you might compare God? Is there any? God has no equal. There is no likeness. There is no substance of any tangible nature on the face of this earth to which you can liken God. The workman melts a graven image to show you the utter stupidity of any of the carvings, the amulets, the relics, or whatever they may be that are supposedly representative of God. How in the world can they be? Is there anything fashionable by man that can be made comparable to God? How utterly stupid that men themselves believe that they can fashion an image of God in configuration, size, shape, characteristics, or whatever, either mentally or physically. The workman melts a graven image, and the goldsmith spreads it over with gold, and casteth silver chains. A stupid comparison, indeed. He that is so impoverished that he hath no oblation chooses a tree that will not rot. Some think that they can represent their God, and really it does, if you understand it. I don't care what they call him. And they have to have very, very, very fine and expensive amulets, relics, and images, because they wouldn't deign to manifest any, what shall we say, the weakness or the lack of any character or the lack of glory within their homes. So the little gods that they set up and whatever they bow down and worship would have to be the most expensive they can procure. But can you imagine that that same God is now carved out of a piece of cedar or fir or a piece of wood in the home of somebody else? Is there a God such as that, that caters to the whimsical nature of a man? If God is represented by a silver image, in all of its purity, in the home of the erudite and the great and the significant of this world, then should it not be the same in the home of somebody else? Or is the God that is being represented in the various homes of human beings today merely the configuration of the minds of human beings? The one wants his home to be glorified, and the other can't afford it, so he's forced into a piece of wood. What a God. But they don't think. You have to ask, why in the world do they have gray matter? And yet they both bow down before them with the total disparity involved. That's what he's saying right here. To whom are you going to liken this God? The God that is not touched by the wealth of one and the impoverished circumstances of somebody else. The same God who is God both of the rich and the poor, if he is the God of anyone. The workman melts a graven image, and the goldsmith spreads it over with gold and casts silver chains that caters to the vanity and the arrogancy of the rich. He that is so impoverished that he hath no oblation chooses a tree that will not rot. Cedar, redwood, juniper, and the various other ones that were chosen. He seeketh unto him a cunning workman to prepare a graven image that shall not be moved. Have you not known? He said, haven't you even given it any thought? Have you not heard? Have it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundation of the earth? It is he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers that stretch out the heavens as a curtain and spreads them out as a tent to dwell in. That bringeth the princes to nothing. He maketh the judges of the earth as vanity. Yea, they shall not be planted. Yea, they shall not be sown. Yea, their stalk shall not take root in the earth. And he shall also blow upon them, and they shall wither, and the whirlwind, the trial of the day that's going to test the character of their metal. And it's going to find every bit of it wanting, shall take them away as stubble, the time of real trial. I'd like to read the rest of it on through 31. I won't take time. You read it and apply it in the context which I have given. So what is the purpose of all this trial? To know God. And they're going to know him. The day is going to come when the wealthy are going to be robbed, when they're going to be no different than the poor, when the gods of silver are going to accomplish no more than the gods of wood, when they're going to be both made alike, when they're going to be subjected to the brutal heat of the fiery trial of the last, and they're both going to melt and be consumed. Isaiah 46. Isaiah, the 46th chapter. And let's begin in verse 5. To whom will you liken me, and make me equal, and compare me, that you may be like? They lavish gold out of the bag, and weigh silver in the balance, and hire a goldsmith, and he maketh it a god. They fall down, yea, they worship. Isn't that just a little bit stupid? When you realize that they made the god. I mean, he didn't just show up. I can understand it, you know, if he just showed up out of the midst of nowhere, you know, and there he stood with all of his lightning glory and his flashing brilliance and so on. But they're the ones that made that stupid thing. And then they bow down and worship it. God says they're stupid and they're brutish. And indeed, they have to be. You know, a god that is remade in the configuration of man's own mental powers is not a god at all. And that was the cardinal factor in effecting my separation from Worldwide Church of God, because they were remaking God in the changes. And if that were God, then, you know, human beings can do as well. Why in the world should I serve him? I thought all those years we were serving a God that was immutable, unalterable, who had made his will known. Because you can't know God until he reveals himself. And once he reveals himself, he's absolute. Then you can't change it. For if you have to change, you didn't know him. It's just that simple. And I could not resolve that in my mind. I asked literally hundreds of questions coming from every vantage point at that time, and none of them came up with a positive, I'll guarantee you. The God that I serve is a God who reveals himself. He's not fashioned by human hands, nor according to the configuration of any human mind. Whomever he is or whatever he may call himself. He is a God who has revealed himself, and you're going to know him only if he reveals himself to you. And you can't make any likeness or any image because you've never seen it. And there is no substance, there is no form, or there's no shape to which you could liken God or that you could give to Him. The only thing we know is, in general, He must appear as human beings because we were made in His image. But how in the world can you give form and shape to spirit? So we can only know God if He is revealed. And isn't that what Jesus Christ said? So He said then to these very people who began to change. That's why you found so much about change in the Old Testament, as it is commonly called. Because they were changing. Their God began to take the shape of a God that they could manipulate, they could carve, they could change in any way they want to, restructure Him, mentally or physically. And it began to happen in our time. But the God who is the true God and the God that the true faithful servants serve is not a God that can be likened unto any physical substance. He cannot be tampered with by minds of human beings. He is God. And all that that name encompasses or implies. You can't restructure Him. You can't remake Him. You know Him if He's been revealed. And when He is revealed, you have one common responsibility: faithfulness. And that's that. And I also knew that God had made Himself known to somebody in the last days. So very quickly I looked all over common religions, and I didn't find any that knew Him. If the worldwide Church of God were not the true Church of God, then you tell me where it is. And yet the Bible said one was going to exist. Not like these argumentations that are going on by people out there, well, there never was. You know, He never was converted. He never was this. Why don't they use their heads? The Bible says it did exist. Do they deny Christ? But that God we cannot make in our image. We can't restructure Him or refashion Him. He was revealed to us. And by that means, we knew Him. And it is our responsibility now to manifest our faith and our confidence in continuity of purpose. Faith and loyalty. Ancient Israel had the same problem. A historical example of what we encountered. And yet, brethren, I have no assurance that even everyone under the hearing of my voice is going to remain faithful. I certainly hope so, and I pray to that end. But how many are not with us now because their faith wouldn't hold out? And they've restructured God in their own minds. To whom will you liken me and make me equal? Is there any metal that you can use and say, here He is? No, God created them all. Is there any form or any shape or any substance that you can use and say, here is a comparable representation? That we may be like. They lavish gold out of the bag and weigh silver in the balance and hire a goldsmith. Marvelous God, isn't it? We bought Him. We bought the gold, we bought the silver, and we hired the goldsmith. And we said, here is the way we want Him to look. You make Him from your skill now. All, most of us wouldn't have images on our mantles or in our homes. And I hope most of us don't carry any of them around in the mantles of our minds. But it's just as easy for people to structure gods in their own human mental conception as it is to construct them from physical substance. And the one is no different than the other. Have we made a God in our image that agrees with us, that subscribes to our philosophy? You know, I've many times said that there isn't a human being on earth that doesn't know what perfection is. Sure, we all do. We're it. When we run into problems or difficulties, if there is a unique situation comes up, it's very uncommon for somebody to say, I'm probably the cause of it. That takes character. No, humanly, we're always right. And we, in a very volatile fashion, react. In like manner, we all know what God is, don't we? It's exactly how we think. For God agrees with us. We've got him right by the tail. And that's not blasphemous, because I'm not talking about the true God. But the God that we made, we got him by the tail, so we tell him which way to go and what to do. Yeah, they lavish gold out of the bag, and we laugh at them who make them. But we haven't seen ourselves in our own minds yet. So we have no room in our minds for contempt or disregard or anything else. We have too much to master and overcome in our own personal lives. And they hire a goldsmith. Well, sometimes we don't hire goldsmiths, but we hire somebody else from whatever technical vantage point to restructure a God that suits us. And he maketh it a God. And they fall down, yea, they worship. Yes, we do. We bow before that altar. We all have that trouble from time to time until we whip it. Because that's what our problem is all about. They bear him upon the shoulder. Isn't that amazing? Here's God. He's right here on my shoulder. Now, how in the world can you get him on your shoulder when even the heaven of heavens can't contain him? When the human mind cannot even comprehend him? But yet they carry him around on their shoulder. They carry him and set him in his place. And they say, now, be a good boy. Just don't get out of hand. And don't be too defensive, and don't create too many problems for me, and don't cause too much distress in my life. Let me do the things pretty well as I want to, and I'll fall down and worship you. You can be my God. They carry him and set him in his place, and he stands. That is, until a wind comes along and knocks him over, like Dagon, you remember? They couldn't quite understand why their God was always falling on his face. From his place he shall not remove. There he sits, going to collect dust. Unless the housewife comes along, you know, and is going to dust the mantle. Then she picks him up, moves him out of his place. Then she gets it all dusted nice and clean. She puts him back in place. And says, now, good boy. And that's God. Yea, one shall cry unto him, yet can he not answer. They can lash themselves, beat themselves, and do all kinds of things, but he isn't going to help them. Nor save him out of his trouble. Remember this and show yourselves men. What he is saying is, why don't you remember to think about it? Show yourselves men. You just stop and think about it. Think of the gods they have now in these various organizations. Think of the God that they finally had in Pasadena. You want that God? The God that you don't know what's going to change tomorrow. He's been changing an awful lot of times. And they restructure him and refashion him according to their new enlightenment day by day, or week by week, or month by month. What a travesty. Remember this and show yourselves men. Bring it again to mind, O you transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God. Now, the best way for us to understand some of the dimension of God is to remember the things of old. That's what he tells us to do. Remember the former things of old, for I am God, and there is none else. I am God, and there is none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning. There was no reason for God to make any mistakes. Not like one minister I heard said, you know, God made the mistake. He revealed the wrong thing to Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong. Almost lost my tongue at that moment. Declaring the end from the beginning. And from ancient times the things that are yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. That's the God, brethren, we serve, who has revealed himself, whom you cannot reclassify on the basis of human concept. Calling a ravenous bird from the east, the man that executeth my counsel from a far country, yea, I have spoken it. I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it. I will also do it. So maybe we'd better start looking to the Word rather than to human concept. Jeremiah 10. Jeremiah, the 10th chapter. And I'm going to... I'm going to have to just simply overlook this point because I have many, many things I want to say in Jeremiah 10 and also Jeremiah 51. So I don't want to get involved in either one of those right now. So it just looks like there's going to be one more sermon on this particular word yet. But I want to take the time, and I want us to see it and to understand. I want us to really realize what that God is. The God that we worship. Not a God that we can restructure or reconfigure according to our thinking. A God before whom we stand who is so awesome, who has revealed himself to us by divine revelation. And that's the only reason you're going to know that God. Who cannot be known by the searchings of man. Who cannot be found out by all the capabilities, quote unquote, of man. Who cannot be reduced to form and shape. Which is merely the restructuring of the conception of man. But God. Who cannot be contained in heaven and earth. The awesome God. And who is working us, fashioning us, if we can only come to understand it and to be faithful, that we may be like unto him. What a day and what a glory. Isn't it worthy of faith and confidence? And a little struggle in the refinement process incumbent upon us today. Will we remember the past? Trials and experiences of that transitory period of time called human existence in the eternity of tomorrow's glory? Think about it. And then maybe the trials and the problems of today will be a little easier to bear.
persecution, trial, and tribulation. The Church of God the Eternal has just presented the number 12 tape in this series of vital interest and intense concern to every Christian. Your speaker has been Mr. Raymond Cole.